I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A Pakistan government spokesperson is now saying that Benazir Bhutto did not die from bullet wounds, but was killed when she hit her head on her vehicle. The spokesman says all three shots missed Bhutto and that she was killed when she tried to duck back into her vehicle after the subsequent suicide bomb blast. Bhutto was laid to rest today in her family mausoleum. In his press conference, Pakistan's interior minister also said that investigators have resolved what he calls the whole mystery of Bhutto's death, claiming to have intercepted calls that indicated a militant leader commanding pro-Taliban forces on Pakistan's lawless border with Afghanistan was responsible for the assassination. Shahan Mufti is with the Christian Science Monitor in Islamabad. Shahan, what do you make of this new conflicting report of how Bhutto died?
Well, Robin, the Interior Ministry has confirmed that there was a suicide bomb blast and gunshots fired, but they're maintaining that she died of hitting her head on a lever on her sunroof when she ducked. This is completely contradictory to what the doctors had reported at the hospital when she arrived, that she had head wounds and just the story that was reported earlier, which described her dying of shots to the neck and the chest. There's a lot of pressure on the Pakistani government to come up with an explanation, obviously, because since the last suicide bombing, which took place in October against Benazir Bhutto, the inquiry of that is still not finished. So this seems like a statement under pressure from the government.
Well, Pakistan's interior minister also said in his press conference today that investigators have resolved what he calls the whole mystery of Benazir Bhutto's death, claiming to have intercepted calls from al-Qaeda leaders congratulating people for killing Benazir Bhutto, and saying the message came from a militant leader commanding pro-Taliban forces on Pakistan's border with Afghanistan. Tell us about that leader. Who is he?
Well, the Interior Minister in the same press conference also read out a transcript of the phone call that you just talked about. This is Baitullah Masood. He is a militant leader in the Waziristan region of the tribal areas of Pakistan. He had made explicit threats in the past and very recently as well on Benazir Bhutto's most recent campaign trail that he would target Benazir Bhutto with suicide bombers. The Interior Minister read out a transcript of a telephone conversation between an unnamed cleric and Baitullah Masood, in which he congratulates Baitullah Masood for sending three suicide bombers to Benazir Bhutto's rally, and two of them managed to kill her with the gunshots and the suicide bombing. So the Interior Ministry right now is claiming that they have solved the mystery and they know who is behind the assassination now.
Shahan, is there any independent investigation of Benazir Bhutto's death? We know there was no autopsy performed. She has been buried. But is there any investigation outside of the government investigation?
Well, Benazir Bhutto's husband, Asif Ali Zardari, who flew in from Dubai last night, declined any. He decided not to have any autopsy performed on the body, and now that Benazir Bhutto is buried in her ancestral graveyard, there will be no autopsy on her body now, probably. So the government statement is the only one that stands right now. There's no independent investigation of the assassination. There's none announced or planned.
And briefly, is there any sense of whether the January 8th elections will go on as planned?
It seems very unlikely, Robin, that the January 8th elections right now will take place as planned, even though the caretaker prime minister has announced that the election schedule stands. It doesn't seem like the Pakistan People's Party will be ready for the elections, and the other major parties in the country have pulled out and already announced a boycott of the elections.
Shahan Mufti of the Christian Science Monitor in Pakistan. Shahan, thanks as always.
It was a pleasure.
And we want to spend a few minutes now with journalist Douglas France. His book, The Nuclear Jihadist, written with his wife, Catherine Collins, details the black market sale of nuclear secrets by A.Q. Khan, Pakistan's top nuclear scientist and the man sometimes called the father of the Islamic bomb. Khan's network spread nuclear knowledge from Pakistan to North Korea, Iran, Libya. And in telling Khan's story, France lays out how the U.S. would often turn a blind eye to problems in Pakistan in exchange for Pakistan's help in fighting U.S. enemies. And Douglas France joins us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington. Doug, welcome.
You're welcome, Robin. Thanks for having me.
And just, you know, going back one day, your reaction, maybe through your lens, when you heard that Benazir Bhutto had been assassinated?
Well, I had two reactions equally strong. I knew Benazir Bhutto quite well. I interviewed her half a dozen times for stories at the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and for this book, The Nuclear Jihadist. And so on a personal level, Catherine and I were both terribly, terribly heartbroken that this happened, although it might have been, in fact, a death foretold. On a second level, though, I think that the assassination of Benazir Bhutto throws Pakistan into enormous chaos and moves it just a step closer to the brink of real instability. And that raises a second, even deeper concern in my mind, and that is what happens to Pakistan's nuclear arsenal. We know now that Pakistan has between 50 and 100 nuclear devices scattered around the country, hopefully in very secure military installations. But nonetheless, we have to be worried now as citizens of the world and citizens of the United States about what happens if Pakistan does take that final step over the edge and falls into complete chaos and into a failed state. What happens with that nuclear arsenal?
Well, and remind us of the story of how the nuclear arsenal came to be, because it's also telling. AQ Khan, of course, brought the bomb to Pakistan and then spread nuclear information further through his black market network. You write his network could have been stopped before it was even started. Let's remind ourselves, he was working in Holland in the 70s. The Dutch knew he was stealing nuclear information from them. They asked the CIA to stop him, but the CIA said they'd rather study him. 4 years later, in 79, they had a clearer picture of him, and Jimmy Carter tried to punish Pakistan for its nuclear ambitions. You pick up the story from there. Then what happened?
Sure. Let me back up 1 second to say that Benazir Bhutto's father, Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto, was the man who started Pakistan's nuclear arsenal, and he began building a nuclear weapon to counter the nuclear program under development by their neighbor and arch-rival India. So Bhutto brought AQ Khan back in 1975, the end of 75. Khan had been working at an uranium enrichment laboratory in Amsterdam, and he stole enormously sensitive plans from that research center and brought them back with him along with a shopping list. And he used the shopping list and those plans to first set up an enrichment plant in Pakistan, in a place called Kahuta, southeast of Islamabad, where he began enriching uranium that formed the fissile material for Pakistan's current nuclear arsenal. And he also used that shopping list to create this black market to buy the technology and the material that Pakistan didn't have, because it was then, as it remains now, a fairly backward country technologically. And so by the early 1980s, Khan had developed enough fissile material that Pakistan could have developed a crude nuclear device. But that was a time when, rather than trying to stop them, the United States had turned, as you said, a complete blind eye to what Pakistan was doing. Jimmy Carter in 1979 in April did impose sanctions on Pakistan to try and stop their nuclear development. But at the end of 1979, the Soviet troops invaded Afghanistan, and Carter made a knowing decision to remove the sanctions and to ignore Pakistan's nuclear program. And that policy held for the next 11 years. And during that time, Pakistan built up a very sophisticated nuclear arsenal to counter India. They didn't test a weapon until 1998. But certainly throughout the 1980s, the United States knew that Pakistan was developing nuclear weapons. And people within the American government who tried to reach out and stop that program, who tried to call attention to it, in fact, were punished. We have a couple of chapters in our book about Richard Barlow, who was a CIA agent at the time and then went to the Defense Department as in the office of Dick Cheney when he was Defense Secretary. And Barlow's story is very interesting because he tried to draw attention within the system to what Pakistan was doing in terms of buying American technology and Canadian technology and European technology. And yet every time he was knocked down, and ultimately he lost his job because he tried to speak out against that.
The first President George Bush, President Clinton, the current President Bush, all also turned largely a blind eye to Pakistan's ambitions. You write there was always a sensible reason, and most recently, of course, the war on terror.
Well, I think what we see really with Benazir Bhutto's assassination yesterday and the possibility of enormous instability in Pakistan is 30 years of failed American policies, you know, going back to Carter's decision in 1979 to allow the nuclear program to continue, going up through the Clinton administration, where they never just took Pakistan seriously enough, never took proliferation seriously enough from the point of view we express in the book. And then on September 11, 2001, the Bush administration really made a deal with Musharraf. You know, he agreed to help them, at least in a grudging manner, in the so-called war on terrorism. And in exchange, the United States not only allowed AQ Khan to continue selling nuclear equipment on the world market for another 3 years, but they also agreed that Musharraf could accumulate more and more powers of a dictator. He'd been in office just about 2 years on September 11th, and there were I met him in September and October of 2001, and at that time the world sort of thought that there was a chance for democracy, that he'd take off his uniform and allow serious, legitimate, and fair elections, but he never did, and the United States never pressured him.
And we should jump in to say that when he overthrew the then prime minister in 1999, Nawaz Sharif, this was a man that was seen by the West as someone who was Islamist, who was leaning to the right, who was perhaps going to bring Sharia law to Pakistan. And so Musharraf, you know, again, another blind eye might have been turned then.
Oh, I think absolutely. I mean, certainly and Nawaz Sharif also was prime minister of Pakistan in May of 1998 when they tested six nuclear devices and drew sanctions from the Clinton administration, which were later removed by the George W. Bush administration after September 11th when we decided we needed to bring Pakistan back into our fold.
And by the way, we're looking again at the assassination of Benazir Bhutto through this nuclear lens. How much was a blind eye turned to whatever, you know, she might have played a part in this because she also promised to bring democracy or was the promise of democracy for Pakistan?
Well, I think Benazir Bhutto is a complicated character. And I think that in the West, certainly in the United States, we tend to view her one way. We view her as a great champion of democracy. She was educated at Harvard. She speaks excellent English. She had a knack for saying exactly what Americans wanted to hear. We have an interesting scene in the book where she came in June of 1989 during her first term as prime minister, and she was permitted to address a joint session of Congress, where she drew a standing ovation when she promised that Pakistan would not develop a nuclear weapon and that she would stop any program to develop a nuclear weapon and that Pakistan, in fact, was not developing a nuclear weapon. Well, I don't think there's any question that Benazir Bhutto knew otherwise. And if she didn't, the next day, William Webster, who was then the director of Central Intelligence, invited her out to Langley, where she was shown a precise model of the bomb that Pakistan was building at that time. You know, so we see two sides of Benazir Bhutto here, I think. And you know, she was, in one sense, a great democratic hope. But in another sense, she was a creature of Pakistan, and she was certainly willing, both primarily in her second term, but also in this return to Pakistan, you know, to do what it took to become prime minister and to grab that seat that she felt really was her destiny.
Doug France, we'll take a minute break. Back with more here and now. We're back with more from Douglas France, co-author with Catherine Collins of the book The Nuclear Jihadists, the story of Pakistan's nuclear scientist AQ Khan, who sold nuclear secrets to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. And Doug, we were just talking about how Benazir Bhutto promised the U.S. Congress that Pakistan was not building a bomb when she and the U.S. knew that Pakistan was. You say she was a creature of Pakistan, meaning she was willing to do what it took to be Pakistan's leader. But was she also trying to do what she thought was right for the region? To be strong or to make compromises necessary to bring democracy to the region?
Perhaps so. But I think she had other goals, too. I mean, and as I said at the start, I mean, I was very fond of her personally, and I have enormous respect for her. But I'm not sure democracy was always at the forefront of her mind. Certainly, we saw in her second term the determination, as she told me in a couple of interviews, to find a way to coexist with the military. And that meant acknowledging and protecting Pakistan's nuclear program. We have an interesting scene in the book where A.Q. Khan himself comes into her office in December of 1993. She's about to make a state visit to China, and A.Q. Khan, who at that time is the public face of Pakistan's secret nuclear weapons program, and he asks her if she'd mind stopping off in North Korea to obtain some missile plans from the North Koreans that he wants to use to build a missile that will carry a nuclear payload to India. And she agreed, and she told us that she agreed because she wanted to find a way to curry favor with the military and with the intelligence services to smooth out her path for the rest of her term.
In reviewing your book, Doug, the Washington Post writes, it gives little ground for optimism that the West will be able to prevent Islamic extremists from getting their hands on nuclear weapons. At the beginning of our conversation, you said that Benazir Bhutto's assassination strikes that very fear in you, the instability of the country. Tell us more about that.
It does. I mean, Pakistan has, as we said, between 50 and 100 nuclear devices. And I think as long as the military and the senior generals now remain in control of Pakistan and of that nuclear arsenal, and never forget, Robin, that the military is the real power in Pakistan. It has been since the country was founded in 1947. As long as the military, the current military leadership, remains in control, I think that those weapons are secure. What really concerns me is this idea that Pakistan tips over and becomes a failed state, because then there are enormously influential, powerful Islamic extremist factions of the political and within the military arenas that could then try to acquire parts of those arsenals. Some of them could fall into the wrong hands if the government fell into chaos. And then it's not so much my concern that they're going to launch against India, but rather that it will get out into this still existing black market. Because every expert that Catherine and I spoke with for the four years in which we researched this book, their ultimate fear is that a terrorist organization or a rogue country will set off, detonate a nuclear device in anger somewhere in the Western world, whether it's the United States or Western Europe, that somewhere in the next few years that will happen, and then that will bring a chaos like we've never heard of before.
Nightmare. And, of course, we remember stories of the U.S., perhaps with that in mind, trying to figure out how to refine the relationship. We remember the U.S. declined to share with Pakistan what is considered one of the crown jewels of the American nuclear protection technology. It's known as PALS, or permissive action links. These are the systems that keep a weapon from detonating without special codes and authorization. The administration, the Bush administration, worried about it falling into the wrong hands. But the Pakistanis, we understand, were sort of hesitant because they worried it might contain a secret kill switch that might stop them from using a weapon. So, you know, obviously they are today doing a dance around the nuclear program.
Well, they sure are. I mean, George Tenet, who was the director of CIA on September 11th, soon after that, he took two of his top nuclear experts and flew to Islamabad, and his goal then was to persuade Musharraf and the leaders around him to allow the Americans to step in and provide these permissive action links, as you mentioned, and other types of security for the Pakistani nuclear arsenal, because the big fear after September 11th was that these devices would fall into the wrong hands. And in fact, those fears were underscored as intelligence surfaced showing that two of A.Q. Khan's associates from Pakistan's nuclear program had been in Kandahar, Afghanistan in August of 2000. And one meeting with Osama bin Laden himself and talking about Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda's desires to possess weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons. And so those concerns on the part of the Bush administration were very real. But if you put yourself in Pakistan's position, there's no way that they're going to let the United States inside their nuclear arsenal. You know, that is really the crown jewel of the military's arsenal there, and they're not going. They didn't permit that, and I think it was overly optimistic to assume that they would. But clearly, what Tenet went attempting to do, and he writes about this in his own book, was to persuade Pakistan to allow new American technology. And I think that Tenet and others within the Bush administration were determined to make Pakistan's nuclear arsenal as secure as absolutely possible. And I believe, contrary to what others have reported, I believe, based on the reporting we did, both with American and Pakistani officials, that the Americans were prepared to provide this permissive action link technology.
But in the end, the Pakistanis were suspicious of it and didn't want it.
Exactly right.
You paint a pretty grim scenario.
It's a very grim scenario about sensitive technology and plans for nuclear warhead designs that have gone missing since A.Q. Khan and his network were brought down at the end of 2003. A.Q. Khan has been sitting in his house in Islamabad under house arrest, and the United States government has not insisted on questioning him and trying to get to the bottom of this nuclear Walmart that he set up, and particularly not asking him exactly and precisely and completely what he sold to Iran and the identity of this unknown customer out there.
Douglas France, author with his wife Catherine Collins of The Nuclear Jihadist, the story of Pakistan's top nuclear scientist and the man called the father of the Islamic bomb, A.Q. Khan. Doug, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And we'll continue to cover this story next week, along with the Iowa caucuses. The Pakistan elections are scheduled for the same day as our New Hampshire primary. We'll cover it all. Still ahead today, the new internet networking scene after the news, here and now. Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, Twitter. The social networking scene on the web took off in the past year, and these sites long ago stopped being just for teens. More than half of MySpace visitors are now over 35 years old. But with so many different networks, many people are finding it difficult to keep track of their friends. There's now a move to allow people to connect across networks. So, for example, if you're a MySpace subscriber, you'll be able to stay in touch with a friend on Facebook. For more on that and a primer of exactly what these sites are and what they do, David Weinberger joins us. He's a fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society and author of Everything is Miscellaneous. David, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin.
It seems like there's a couple of different tiers of social networking going on now. You know, I do not Facebook, if that can be used as a verb, but there's personal, professional, you know, mundane. Take us through some of the uses.
Tiers is actually way too organized for what's going on. There are social networking sites for every type of social network, just about, including some that probably haven't existed before. So there are general purpose ones like Facebook and MySpace and Friendster originally. And so if you have friends, you have a social network, and you want to keep in touch with them, that's a good place to go. If you have special interests, there are tons and tons of other places, new ones springing up all the time, impossible to keep up with them. So there are ones for business people. LinkedIn and Zing is another, that's with an X. Zing is a more global one. But there are social networks based around sort of demographic sectors. There's Black Planet, which claims to have 16 million registered users, which is a lot. That's for African Americans. There are ones that are based around interests as well, or even objects. And Flickr is a very popular site for uploading and sharing photographs, but it has a social networking component as well, who gets to see the photographs, who your friends are.
Huh. Well, you know, I know people might be thinking, well, most recently when I heard about Facebook, it was that terrible story of the young girl who killed herself when somebody was making believe they were a boy and, you know, they weren't, and tricked her and then bullied her. But I feel I need to point out that for these huge populations that are now gathering in cyberspace, it feels like there's very few of those kinds of problems. It feels like for so many people getting together, it seems to be going pretty well.
Yeah, it is going pretty well. Problems in society get mirrored in the social networking sites. They're actually under a little bit more control than a lot of other public places. So in some ways, there are fewer problems. And you can limit your Facebook friends to people who you actually know. And so that's likely to drive away some of the, or prevent some of the normal sort of social problems.
Even though, you know, the rare situation is a pretty awful one that we hear about. Well, Twitter is the website that allows people to communicate their most immediate thoughts in very short sentences. I'm on your Twitter thing. What do you call it? A Twitter site? What is this?
Your Twitter home.
Your Twitter home. And I'm looking, you're having exchanges with different people. One line a piece, is that the idea? Just very short?
140 characters, yeah. So that's about one good sentence's worth.
Well, and I'm wondering, though, why wouldn't this just be something where you'd email back and forth to someone?
Well, a couple of reasons. The barrier to email is actually higher. You usually have to have something worth emailing about and something worth the person opening the email for, and which is a reasonable thing. At Twitter, the barrier is very, very low. So it can be a passing thought. Some people Twitter what they're doing throughout the day. I just went to the dentist. I walked the dog. Personally, for me, that's not so interesting. But people frequently will Twitter sort of one level up in interest. So the barrier is very low. And the second thing is that unlike email, Twitter is, well, it's a social networking site. It's semi-public. So you can see a stream, a constant scroll of what your friends have been Twittering. That is, what they've been doing throughout the day, what they're thinking. And so you go there and you read the scroll and you see what's new and different than email, which is sort of more news and message-based.
Well, and as you said, it just opens it up to the world. Twitter has been criticized, though, for creating artificial intimacy because, as you said, maybe you're not sharing anything meaningful. It's just Twitter.
Well, sure. But, you know, you can compare it, especially this time of year, you can compare it to the year-end roundups that you get from friends you haven't seen in a year, basically.
And
you
get the Christmas letters.
The Christmas letter. And you get the, you know, the top level, the five big things that happened. Here's Mary Sue got accepted and so forth. And that's great and that's important. And there is some level of intimacy to that. But, you know, you could look at that and say, well, that's just like reading somebody's newspaper. That's not very personal. Whereas Twitter, you may not be getting the big milestones because throughout the course of a day, how many milestones do you have? But you're getting a continuous feed of details about the person's life. You're staying much more closely in touch with the person, and there is a certain intimacy to details.
We mentioned that there's a move afoot to allow people to somehow merge the information of these sites. Tell us about that, and why is that important?
Well, it's a big can of worms. It's important because people invest a great deal of time and information and personal information in their social networks, whether it's Facebook or whatever. They say, these people are my friends, these people aren't, and then they engage in a set of information sharing and building up details and knowledge of one another, and there's a huge amount of value in that, I mean, just personal value. It's economic value, too, but that's a different story. So how do I move my social network from one spot to another? These social networks are so deep and complex and so filled with permissions, implicit and explicit, and relationships, it's very hard to move one to another place. That's a real problem.
So what is the suggestion to merge the work?
There's a suggestion that addresses one side of the problem. It's called open social. It was instigated by Google, and Google has gathered an alliance, basically an everybody but Facebook alliance. And the idea there is not quite to move the data from one place to another, but to allow developers to create applications, you know, software that does interesting things, that's able to get at the information that's in each of the sites. So a developer wouldn't have to write an application that only works in Facebook, for example, but could write one that works across all of the participating social networking sites.
Why does all this matter? I mean, why, you know, you tell me how important these are, these social networking sites.
In a sense, they merely repeat the most important thing about the web, in my view, which is the web allows people to connect with one another. But the web doesn't really know anything about who your friends are. These sites do, because you've told them. It's simply a better way of enabling people to connect with one another and to take care of one another.
By the way, David Weinberger, you were in Oslo during the Nobel Peace Prizes, and you were at the concert afterwards, and you were Twittering from there.
I felt like I had both a sort of a citizen journalist obligation and opportunity, and it was such, in some ways, a bizarre event, the Peace Prize concert. You know, Earth, Wind, and Fire is playing at this thing. I'm still not sure why.
Global warming.
Oh, yeah.
That's what it is.
They should have left fire home.
So what are you just doing? Just shooting out a line at a time about what you're seeing?
Yes, and I tried to be polite by not sort of having my well-lit BlackBerry lighting up in the middle of a song. But yeah.
Just letting people know.
A little commentary, that's all.
Just connecting to the world. David Weinberger is a fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, author of Everything is Miscellaneous. David, thanks as always.
Well, thank you. It looks got so very dear. Oh, yeah. To shine so. You gotta who you are. Shine bright, see. But you do be. To be.
Any excuse to play Earth, Wind, and Fire. Here they are at the Nobel concert. Coming up, jazz and food for New Year's party, here and now. now comes the cleanup. For many, post-Christmas means recycling your wrapping paper, your Christmas dinner leftovers, and then there's that tree. In Cook County, Illinois, volunteers haul Christmas trees by snowmobile out to Baker Lake Island to harbor nesting herons. In southern Louisiana, Christmas trees are used to help build up eroding coastal marshes. In Wisconsin, a paper mill burns used trees for fuel. And in Lake Havasu City, Arizona, well, let's ask them what they do. Kirk Cook manages the Lake Havasu Fisheries Program in Arizona's Mojave County. He joins us now. Kirk, what do you do with Christmas trees?
Well, we collect them up from the community and install them in Lake Havasu as fish habitat improvement.
How do you install them? What do you do?
Typically, we'll get some trees that didn't sell before the holidays from vendors, and then we just encourage the community to, when they take their tree down after Christmas, deliver it to a central collection point, and we work with waste management people in the community, and they bring us the Christmas trees to a shoreline campsite, and then we organize some volunteers who attach sandbags to the trees. We put the trees and the sandbags on a large pontoon boat and deliver them to a location on the lake where we'll put them in 15 to 20 feet deep water, and it serves as structure for young fish, old fish, and we help our fish populations out that way.
Well, Christmas trees form a sort of reef down there.
Absolutely. And it's all organic. It decomposes over time, and they last for maybe 8, 10, 12 years and really perform a good function for us.
And there's more reason why you do it, because I guess Lake Havasu was sort of a desert reservoir, very little vegetation. How did you describe it to us?
I tried to equate it to a bathtub, and essentially the rocky, sandy landscape was just flooded with water, and very few shrubs or trees associated with that reservoir when it filled. And fish really relate well to structure, and by putting in some artificial reefs and the Christmas trees and the rest of the things that we do, it provides a home for young fish to grow up, and we've had some really good results from it, Robin.
And we understand that the fact that it's so increased the fish population and made them happy, it's had a good impact on tourism as well.
Well, absolutely. The health and the vitality of the fishery is what attracts fishermen.
Where I was growing up on Long Island, we used to take our Christmas trees out to the ocean dunes, you know, to use them as a buffer against the winds and erosion. People doing this all across the country. But, you know, the Colorado River feeds Lake Havasu, so why is it so naked? You'd think that there would be debris flowing into it.
Well, the Colorado River is probably one of the most allocated water sources in the United States. We've got a large dam network spread throughout the watershed, and so the runoff, the debris that used to come down into this lower Colorado River area is now caught up behind reservoirs upstream. And we're in a precipitation zone here where we get maybe 2-3 inches of rain a year on a wet year. And so we don't get a whole lot of runoff from the watershed, and consequently, not a whole lot of structure gets washed into the reservoir.
Well, and thanks to the noble Christmas tree, you've been able to correct this problem. That's Kirk Cook. He's Lake Havasu Fisheries Program Manager there in Arizona. Kirk, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure, Robin. Thank you.
Okay, now let's get this out of the way. There's a big football game tomorrow night, the New England Patriots against the New York Giants. There's probably nothing we can say you haven't already heard about the undefeated Patriots' attempt to be the first team in NFL history to win 16 games in the regular season. But maybe you didn't know that for a handful of New Englanders, this is epic in other ways as well. At one time, the Giants were the New England team. The Patriots only played their first game in 1960. In fact, one of the biggest advertisers here is a glass company named after the New York team back when the Giants were the rage. Their ubiquitous ad is hummed by everyone, many oblivious to the fact that they're singing an ode to Saturday's enemy. We called Giant Glass today to confirm that story. They said they were sort of downplaying that aspect of their history right now. Understood. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now, and New Year approaches. You may be looking for things to liven up your celebration, so we thought we'd help by bringing you a conversation we had at this time last year.
I want some barbecue, chicken and fried potatoes, string beans and carrots and stewed tomatoes, cornbread muffins and candy yam, buttermilk biscuits and Virginia ham. I want to rock.
All right, who's hungry? If you're planning a New Year's party, there are three key ingredients: good food, good music, good friends. And we have all three right now. We've got our friends, resident chef Kathy Gunst. Hi, Kathy.
Hello.
And jazz aficionado James Isaacs. How are you, James?
Hi, Robin.
So we've got the food picks, the jazz picks, the friends. This song that we're listening to, James, tell us who the artist is.
The artist is Slim Gaylord, full name Bulee, spelled B-U-L-E-E, Slim Gaylord, the clown prince of jazz. And in fact, Slim was born on New Year's Day back in 1916. He left this world in 1991, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he not only played piano and guitar, he played the vibes, the trumpet, various saxophones, percussion, and when he played the piano, he played it upside down. And by that I mean he played with his palms up quite often, just as something to keep him from being bored, I guess.
That is so weird. Well, okay, so that's Slim Gaylord's Eatin' with Boogie from his Smorgasbord LP.
Yeah, and he also created the language of vout, V-O-U-T. In this language, he would add the suffix vout to a lot of words. For example, when he's speaking to Dizzy Gillespie on a record that they made called Slim's Jam, he calls him Daz McSkiven's Valso Rooney. Now, there's no vout in there, but you get the idea. Rooney is also a big part of Slim's language. Slim loved to write about food. He loved songs about food. There are a number of food songs in his catalog, including a couple we won't hear today, like Matzo Balls and Avocado Seed Soup Symphony.
Darn!
He would often, in the studio, at one point, he says to no one in particular, "Bring me a big bowl of avocado seed soup so I can nail the seeds to the roof."
Okay. We are going to hear more of his music, though. Kathy Rooney?
Yes, Robin Rooney.
Robin O'Rooney.
We want to switch
here
over.
And now Rooney.
We want to switch over to the food side
Mickey
of
Rooney.
The segment. Mickey Rooney. Mickey would be Mickey Rooney Rooney.
Yeah.
Give us some tips for New Year's Eve from the food side.
Well, usually New Year's Eve is about simple and decadent, caviar and champagne. Thing about caviar is it's sort of the ultimate luxury food, and everybody thinks you have to be a zillionaire to take part in it. You don't, in fact. You could buy just a little bit to share with that certain someone on toast points, on very, very thin potato slices. And I would say that champagne is the drink of choice to go with that. But, you know, a beautiful stew this time of year, a coq au vin, chicken simmered in a good bottle of red wine with some mushrooms. Let it cook up 2 days before, then you do nothing that night. The key to a good party is doing as little as possible
right.
on the night of the party.
See, because you could just put out, watch this segue, James, some potato chips. Back
potato
to James.
Chips, how my mouth just drips.
Crunch, crunch, I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips. Potato chips, how my mouth does drip. Potato chips, how my mouth does drip. Crunch, crunch, I don't want no lunch. All I want is potato chips. No matter where it is.
Slim Gaylord, by the way, was quite popular from the late 1930s and into the 40s, and I should mention some of his hits because I would imagine that some folks out there have heard Cement Mixer, Putty Putty, Poppity Pop Goes the Motorcycle, Tutti Frutti, not Little Richard's Tutti Frutti.
Last party I went to, that's what they played.
There you go. And finally, the Flatfoot Fluji with the Floy Floy.
Right, that's it?
Yeah, Slim and Slam had the hit, Slam being Slam Stewart, bass player and vocalist, Slim's partner for a number of years.
Okay, but we are listening to
Potato Chips
from the CD Laughing and Rhythm, the Best of the Verve Years. It was recorded in 1952.
Also okay. correct.
Potato Chips, we swing back to the rest of the menu with Kathy Gunst. Because you can put out potato chips.
Oh, sure. I love potato chips.
Tell us more.
Tell you more. Well, I know that you don't eat meat, correct?
Right.
So one of my, okay, we got two of them here. Roasted vegetable platter. You take every gorgeous winter vegetable you can find, a winter squash, onions, garlic, beets, parsnips, carrots. You put them in a roasting pan. You drizzle them with olive oil, some fresh herbs. You pop them in the oven at 450 and you walk away. Mm. And an hour later, you put together a platter of the most spectacular winter roasted vegetables, serve them with a green sauce made with capers and parsley. That would be a beautiful celebratory dish that could go with a roast if you were a meat eater, or it would be your main course if you were not. There's so many different ways to go. Simple is the key. Yeah. No stress. Be relaxed. It's all about being with the people, hearing the music, sitting back, and letting go of the year.
Well, speaking of relaxing and romantic, I mean, some people have just an evening for two, and so we're going to switch the mood somewhat.
Yeah.
James, we understand you're bringing us a classic for that kind of mood, Ella.
Robin, I am. The tune is What Are You Doing New Year's Eve? It was written in 1947 by Frank Lesser. He's the man who gave the world Guys and Dolls and How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, so a very successful Broadway composer and lyricist. Ella's recording was made in 1960 with Frank Duvall and his orchestra, and indeed it is very romantic.
Maybe it's much too early in the game. Oh, but I thought I'd ask you just the same. What are you doing?
Suddenly, just feel so
gorgeous,
relaxed, don't you?
Yeah.
What would you, Kathy, do for this kind of a mood?
Little mini raspberry-filled chocolate cakes. They're like souffles, but none of the fuss. You mix about four ingredients, pop them in the oven 15 minutes before you're ready to relax.
And this is when one realizes that, you know, potato chips really don't make it at a time like this, because you've got some of these right here in these little ramekins. Is that the right
ramekins,
word?
Ramekins, yep. Little chocolate souffle, one for each, or share.
It's just, they're beautiful, and they're kind of, you know, harder on the top, and then look at that inside.
Yeah, oozy, and you've got a whole layer of fresh raspberries right there in the middle.
Hey, give me a hint for this, because when you were making these today in our kitchen here, I kept saying, don't slam the doors, everybody, but that you say that wouldn't have hurt them. What's a great tip for making the best souffles?
Well, these souffles, they don't have beaten egg whites. You avoid all that fuss. It's just chocolate and butter and a little bit of sugar and a tiny bit of flour. It's almost like a flourless chocolate cake more than a souffle, but you can see they've been out of the oven for 5 minutes. They're still crowned and puffed.
It's wonderful. And by the way, we'll have the recipes, the songs, a lot more for you on our website, here-now.org. In the meantime, James, as we enjoy our souffles, you've got something to underscore that. Duke?
Duke, but what I have is the traditional New Year's song, the tune that always rings out the old and rings in the new, Auld Lang Syne. And, of course, Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians owned this song years ago when New Year's Eve from New York was broadcast nationally on television. Mm-hmm. But Ellington recorded Auld Lang Syne kind of as a tribute to Guy Lombardo and his Royal Canadians. This is from 1962. Duke Ellington and his orchestra, Auld Lang Syne. Happy New Year.
Same to you.
Happy New Year.